You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Ryan Stacy. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, September 1st, 2016.
But everybody got together. It was one big happy family, and it was really like Bloomington's own little Chelsea Hotel.
We hear from Peter Lopilato of The Rider in today's episode of Big Talk with Mike Glad. That's coming up later in the show.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks you who you think of when you hear the word elites. But first, these local headlines.
The city and developer HM Mack have come to a final agreement on just how much of a tax break it will give on what's been dubbed the Chocolate Moose Project and what the city will get in return. Discussions have been going on for the past 2 months about how to include and pay for affordable housing units in the $11.5 million housing complex on South Walnut Street, where the Chocolate Moose now stands. This latest agreement approved last night provides a $1.3 million 10-year tax break in exchange for 15 bedrooms of affordable housing. Councilmember Isabel Piedmont-Smith led the negotiations.
The workforce units will also remain in perpetuity, or as long as we can legally define that, which is 99 years, at an affordable rate. And even with fluctuations in what the living wage may be and what the market value of the units may be, it would never exceed 85% of what the market rate of these apartments may go for.
The council previously approved the site as an economic development target area in its July 13th meeting. Saying she wasn't a fan of tax abatements, Piedmont-Smith said the number of units and the longevity of the arrangement will serve as a model for the future. Councilmember Steve Volan described the arrangement as precedent-setting.
We've gone back and forth trying to figure out what would be fair, but I think that the resulting amendment is substantially an improvement over the initial proposal for simply 5% of the beds for a three-year abatement. We think that this is the way that we should be wielding tax abatements to bring affordable housing to Bloomington.
According to Volan, the new agreement will result in a $1.3 million tax break for the developer over 10 years, but he said the city was getting the better end of the deal.
We've done the math on this, and the amount of rebated rent or of reduced rent that will accrue to workforce housing over the next century, but from the get-go, will be substantial and substantially more than the amount the petitioner will receive in tax breaks.
Councilmember Susan Sandberg described the new arrangement as very palatable. Councilmember Chris Sturbaum said, quote, "What we know is the market will not build this kind of housing by itself," unquote. Council President Andy Ruff explained how the larger taxpaying community will be affected.
It's not really that any taxes are forgone. Any taxes are not realized by the community under a tax abatement like this. They're picked up by all the other tax in a small increment by the other property-owning taxpayers of the community. And if we believe that this is a community good, then it makes sense. I think it's logical and justifiable to think of spreading that that small increase that would support this project over the rest of the taxpayers in the community.
In related action, the council adopted an amendment to the agreement that would broaden eligibility for the affordable housing units, also called workforce housing. The city's assistant director for small business, Jason Carnes, explained.
You have to hold a full-time job of at least 35 hours a week, and then under number two, you have to be able to check off the box, so to speak, for one of those two. Either a total household income is less than 80% of area medium income for your size, or all the wage earners have to earn less than the Bloomington living wage. This way, it really, we feel this captures the demographic that we're targeting with workforce housing.
Rent in the workforce housing apartments will be set at $641 for a one-bedroom and $1,282 for a two-bedroom. The prices will inflate based on the Consumer Price Index.
Last night, the City Council also gave Duke Energy the approval it needs to build a controversial substation in the Maple Heights neighborhood. The project at the corner of 11th and Roger Streets has been unpopular. Neighbors raised concerns about noise, aesthetics, effects on nearby property values, and more. The City Council had some leverage in the debate because the city controls two alleyways that Duke wants to build over. After months of negotiations, the two parties agreed Duke could build the facility if the substation, if it included an 18-foot wall around the facility, and made some other changes to the design. Attorney Bill Beggs, who represented Duke Energy, spoke to the council last night.
While each and every substation won't share these same characteristics, we assure you, we told you we would be concerned about and listening to the neighbors and the council, and you have received what you've asked for within the bounds of what we have to do in order to operate as a utility.
Under the agreement, Duke also agrees to sell any land that's not used by the facility so that it can be developed. They also will allow the city to install landscaping on the property.
In budget hearings last night, the Monroe County Council approved a 2017 budget of $2.5 million for the Solid Waste Management District, which includes $100,000 to hire a consultant for creating the Materials Recovery Facility, or MRF. Executive Director Tom McGlasson said the consultant will help the department broaden its view on the dual-stream MRF project.
There's been $100,000 appropriated in next year's budget to bring in a consultant to kind of look at the whole materials recovery facility idea with a new set of eyes. We're also talking about, you know, broadening the scope of what we're looking at and trying to look at that more from the perspective of the community as a whole and not just the district and the district's material.
McGlasson said the department is not currently conducting discussions with any particular consultant, but he described what he hoped to gain from hiring a consultant.
The viability of you know, whether it be a clean stream, you know, a waste stream or a dual stream MRF, I mean, all of that is a part of it, helping to identify a location where such a facility could exist and have a chance to succeed, as well as helping, you know, once we identify that, look at, you know, help us identify what's it going to cost to build, to retrofit, whatever the site that was chosen needed to be done. You know, circumstances, time, and money permit, you know, look beyond just the district and what the district does and look at the county's waste management as a whole and you know, whether this facility or through some other avenue, what can we do to help improve the way that we manage waste?
If the county creates a dual stream MRF, it will be able to both separate recyclables from trash as well as process pre-sorted recyclables. McGlasson said the budget also includes the cost of leasing two roll-off trucks and 20 to 25 roll-off boxes that would allow his department to move material on its own instead of contracting the work out. Details are still to be worked out regarding where material will be hauled and where the trucks and boxes will be stored. Councilmember Jeff McKim said he supports hiring a consultant.
I think it'll be valuable to have a second set of eyes on the MRF operation. It'll be very important for the board to convey to this consultant that they truly want an unbiased view.
McKim went on to ask whether the Solid Waste Management District's board is considering eliminating the fee currently charged for recycling electronics, saying he felt it was, quote, a step in the wrong direction, unquote. Board Chair Julie Thomas said the fee was necessary.
It's certainly not something we want to do, but it's certainly something we felt like we had to do because the cost went up so high. And that's related to commodity costs elsewhere in other parts of the country. Mm-hmm, yeah. And if gas prices go back up, typically those costs will go back down. So there's a little give and take there. It's certainly not something that we're happy to have, but it's something that it's necessary to have.
McGlasson also noted his budget did not include any employee raises. The department is expecting a rise in insurance costs, which McGlasson said has been absorbed into the operation budget. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Ryan Stacey.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. The Writer magazine and film series have been Bloomington institutions for 5 decades. Founder, publisher, and film curator Peter Lopilato started the sibling operations in a cramped artist studio doubling as his apartment above what is now the Uptown Cafe. The building was once known as the Chelsea Hotel of Bloomington. His is the story of a man with an idea and not enough good sense to ignore it, the quintessential American success tale. Peter joins Michael Glab on this week's episode of Big Talk.
Peter, welcome. Thanks for being on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mike.
You run the Writer film series. You run the Writer magazine.
Yeah, even that word, run, is disputable.
How's that?
I would say there's a better chance that they run me.
Speaking of that, how long have either you been running the Writer or the Writer has been running you?
Well, too long is the short answer, but 1979.
What would cause a person to come up with such a crazy idea?
You know, my parents used to say that to me. It was in 1979, there were a number of weekly newspapers or news magazines in Bloomington that I was writing for. And in those days, everybody pitched in. So you wrote, or at least I wrote, and then I helped with editing, and I learned how to do layout back when cutting and pasting was really cutting and pasting. And so those publications, as they tend to do over a period of time, the people that started them just, there was never any money involved, really.
Uh-huh.
And the people that started them just ran out of energy or moved on to other cities. So I had some ideas about, you know, the way a publication might be done, and maybe done a little differently, and so I wanted to try them.
All right, so you get the idea that you could do something a little bit different, but where do you think the money's going to come from?
I had no idea. I mean, I could tell you where the money did come from.
Tell me.
Yeah, I went out and sold enough ads to cover the printing bill and some other expenses, and I convinced people to pay in advance.
Do you happen to recall the first big article you had in that first issue?
I think we had in that first issue a feature article by a young man named Anthony DeCurtis, who went on to write for Rolling Stone. He's an editor at Rolling Stone, and he's published books, and he's a music journalist. That article, he wrote about an up-and-coming young singer-songwriter who had just released his initial album, and he said, "You're going to hear from this person someday. He's going to have staying power."
And that would be?
Elvis Costello.
Did you envision it lasting, let's not even say 40 years, let's say
40 days.
40 days,
did you envision that? Yeah, it was a temporary thing. It was, let's just see how long we could do this for a while.
Where did the film series fit into this crazy idea?
Yeah, it didn't. It doesn't really fit in a sense, but you know, I grew up in the New York area.
Okay.
And I was hearing from friends and family members about movies that they were watching in New York that never came here, I've always been interested in movies. I was also interested in coming up with some way, you know, we published a magazine, we were in a small office and on Kirkwood Avenue, above where the Uptown Cafe is now. You know, that building was, at that time, it was the Allen Building.
Mm-hmm.
And it was...
Was it falling apart at the time?
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
But it was... It was Artist Lofts.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was a very cool place. Actually, it was interesting because it was a combination. So there were these, you know, for lack of a better term, hipster vagabond artists that were living there, and they were doing interesting stuff. But there were also people living there who were, you know, on fixed incomes, and they were in their, like, 50s and 60s and maybe even a little older than that, that had lived there for many years. And so, but everybody got together. It was one big happy family. And it was really like, you know, I've said this before, but it was really like Bloomington's own little Chelsea Hotel. But in any event, we were in an office there, and which was also doubling as my apartment at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking for some way to actually have some sort of, to meet our readers, to have some sort of contact with them face to face. And so that was part of what I was thinking when I thought maybe we'd show some movies and people would come and have a good time. It was just sort of a fleeting idea, and I said, well, let's just do this and see what happens.
Okay, let's get this straight.
So,
1979 for the magazine.
April 1st.
1979. Oh, very fitting, April Fools. Now, when, probably you don't have the date for the movie series.
Yeah, but it was sometime in late July.
Of?
79.
Oh, so that very same year.
Yeah.
So you started it all off. Where did you exhibit the film?
There's a club. It used to be called Atlas at one time. It was called Mars at one time.
Ah.
It's been under a number of different owners. It's had many different names. At that time, it was owned by a former IU basketball player. His name is Archie Dees.
Okay.
And so it was called Time Out. And I knew him. And I knew even better his the manager of the club, whose name was Skip Twitchell.
Uh-huh.
And... So I ran the idea by him, and he helped us out, and we started the film program.
Do you happen to recall the film?
The first movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was His Girl Friday.
Get out.
Yeah, it was.
One of my favorites.
Well, one of mine
Howard
as well.
Howard Hawks.
Howard Hawks, Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell. It's about as good as it gets, you know?
One of my...
You can argue that to this day, that's the best film we've ever shown.
Okay.
You can argue that our film series has gone downhill from there in terms of quality.
Did you have any idea that this film series would last more than 40 minutes?
No. We rented a projector.
Uh-huh.
Just the film series was one night a week at that point.
Okay.
So it was on a Wednesday night, and we just every Wednesday I went over and rented the projector for the night.
So
and brought it back the next morning. So there was no commitment from that in that sense. There was no big investment. And then I think after a year, maybe, I thought to myself, hey, this is working. So we actually went out and bought a couple of projectors. I'm sure they were used at the time.
What
and
kind
you know
of
who
projectors?
Gave us a projector, by the way? Doc Councilman.
No kidding.
He gave us a projector.
Who was very well known for using video cameras underwater. Yeah.
And he and his wife and his daughter used to come to movies. And one day, I mean, I think his wife was the one who was sort of dragging him along.
Oh, really?
To the films. But they came pretty regularly. And, one day they offered us a projector that they were no longer using. You know, one of the biggest mistakes I ever made in my life. And this just shows, God, I regret this. So I used to go to New York a lot to see movies because that was the only place I could see them at the time. So I would probably spend, I don't know, maybe 10 weeks a year in New York City.
Huh.
And my parents still live there. So it was, and I went to a lot of films at Lincoln Center, mm-hmm. where they had four or five theaters at that time. And that's where all the foreign films were, many of the foreign films were shown. And I might see two or three movies a day, and I'd have some time in between films. So sometimes I'd have an hour, and I'd go get a cup of coffee somewhere. And there was this coffee shop right around the corner. And I went there once or twice, and the coffee wasn't especially good, but really, even worse, it didn't have the sort of hipster cachet that made me want to go back again.
Right.
So I would go out of my way. I would walk 5-6 blocks, and I often had a limited amount of time. I would walk 5 or 6 blocks to some other place that just had the right ambiance. And so years later, I found out that John Lennon used to hang out in the place that I had spurned.
Wow. Well, no wonder he
because
did.
Because he would go there because no one else went there.
Including you.
Including me.
That'll teach you.
Yeah.
So you're wanting to be a hipster so badly.
Yeah, right. What did I know?
That was WFHB correspondent Mike Glab speaking with Peter Lopalato of The Writer. You can hear that in every episode of Big Talk at WFHB.org.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and the mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Up next is our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. This week on Voices in the Street, the power behind politics, defining the elite. Political elite are defined as a small group of powerful people in political and sociological theory, such as an oligarchy, that controls a disproportionate amount of wealth or political power in society. It has become common practice to accuse a political opponent of elitism, and this year's presidential election is no different. But who are the elite? Voices in the Street hit the streets to ask your friends and neighbors who you think constitute the elite in the United States today.
The NRA, maybe?
Oof, boy, I haven't been following much of that. I haven't heard much about the elites, but to me that sounds like, I guess, the people that are control everything, the people that have the money, people in charge of the Fortune 500 companies, the talking heads you see on TV. That's who I think when you say elites.
I wouldn't visualize neither one of them being an elite candidate, but Trump is dominating the media more than Hillary is, and she has a lot of negative connotation towards her name. So I would say right now Trump is in better standing than her, but I don't think neither one of them are great for leading our country. I figure some of the elites that people may be referring to would be like, because I know the Koch brothers have a heavy hand in politics and they are a driving force behind a lot of candidates. So definitely the people who sponsor the candidates can be seen as the elite who try to control America.
I would define it as the 1%.
Yeah, just the people that control the world's wealth, I guess.
That's a tough question. Well, I'm an environmentalist based, so I would say like Monsanto or the big oil companies. But I don't know. I think the election this year is both just like both parties just basically gave a big FU to the American public. I'm actually looking at Gary Johnson, libertarian. He's not bad. He agrees with Bernie on some of the foreign policy, and he doesn't really have a call on social issues because he thinks government should be out of it. But I hope neither one wins, except for Johnson. Well, Johnson's environmentalist policies are not very good. I just think they are better than what we would get with Trump, and I don't think Hillary's stance on most things is very serious.
The top 1% that controls like 50% of the country, or you know, assets of the country, that's the elite. Yeah, I mean, it's financial, but they can also lobby and get whatever the they want, you know? It's probably pecuniary, but it's also a function of probably power because they just have lobbyists and Congress is controlled. However, if Hillary Clinton is not elected, then evidently Donald Trump will be. And, I mean, it's existentially, you know, dangerous for America if Donald Trump is elected. So all you Bernie Sanders fans, I went to the Bernie Sanders thing. It was awesome. And, you know, he's great, but a lot of his platform got now on the Democratic ticket. And so all those Bernie holdouts out there say, no, I'll never vote for Hillary. Please, I mean, the alternative is Trump. And to give a FU to, I don't want to ever vote for Hillary, the corollary is, Mr. Trump might well be the president, and he'll have up to four Supreme Court nominees, you know, to choose from. It's just a travesty. And, you know, apparently he loves Vladimir Putin, who, you know, I don't know if you know about the DNC leak, but evidently there might have been orchestrated by Russia. Go figure, right? I wonder who Vladimir wants as his, counterpart, you know?
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Joe Crawford, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature today was produced by Michael Glab.
Voices in the Street was produced by Kelly Worley. Our engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Ryan Stacey.
And I'm Carolyn Vanderweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.